This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
I'm Helen Farmer. Fantastic to have you with us on the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. We had some amazing experts discussing career and the law. And kicking off today's show, lawyer Ludmila Maliva was live in the studio discussing some of the new work permits available in the UAE and addressing your questions on everything from wills to rent caps to adultery. If you're a startup in the food and beverage industries, then maybe the new co-kitchen can help. And if it's beauty business that you're interested in, we had a consultant joining us live. Plus, should you apply for a job you're not quite qualified for? We spoke to an industry insider. And beauty entrepreneur Ophelia explaining how she went from nurse to salon owner.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Ludmila Maliva of HPL and Malvin Plucker in the hot seat in the studio today, primed and ready. She's got papers and highlighters ready to take your questions. We've already had a real mixed bag of all sorts, to be honest, this afternoon. No problem too big or too small. Don't feel silly for getting in touch, looking for some clarification on anything. This is your chance to get the answers that you need. Maybe the reassurances, maybe an action plan. But please don't be shy. Don't wait for us to bring up the exact situation you find yourself in. And don't worry about putting your name on a message if you'd rather not. 4001 is that SMS to contact the studio, ARN Play app, and the WhatsApp too. Now, Ludmila, let's kick off with some work chat, because a permit came out 2 months ago looking at the guidelines requirements for part-time and temporary work. But this was over the summer. I was away, you were away, and I think some clarification has been asked from a number of different sources. So are you able to kind of outline what happened then and perhaps have a look at what we know now in terms of how it's evolved?
Indeed. So what this refers to is the new labor law in simple terms. And the new labor law, as many will recall, was introduced or became effective as of February of this year, February 2 of 2022. And that was law number 33 of 2021. Now, that's the foundational law. But that law also referred to a set of guidelines and resolutions and regulations to be issued later in time. And so one of the resolutions we're waiting for, or the guidelines regarding how some of these new type of working arrangements that the new law addressed would ultimately be played out in real life. Mm-hmm. And in particular, if you recall, one of the big developments and one of the big changes and evolutions in the UAE employment law is the introduction of flexibility of type of working relationships. So if in the past, in the previous law, there was nothing but full-time employment, that
all
was
or nothing.
Indeed. So the new law specifically and expressly addresses or introduces part-time employment, project-based employment, temporary employment, a mission type of employment, and so on and so forth. Now, so that the legal framework was set out in that law, but in terms of how these types of new working arrangements will be implemented, now was addressed and finally addressed over the summer, as you rightfully said, in the administrative resolution, which was number 38 of 2022. And then also there was another, and there's a whole series of resolutions in the interest of listeners' sanity. I won't go through the list of them.
A lot of paper.
But the key here is this administrative resolution number 33 of 2022, because that particular resolution sets out specific guidelines and procedures for the different types of work permits. So, for example, if you want to apply for a temporary work permit, and just quickly, a temporary work permit, it's not part-time employment, it's temporary, and it's maximum for 6 months. So, for example, you wanted to work during your summer holiday somewhere else, or during your leave time, or while you're visiting for 3 months. That's the temporary work permit. Then there's the part-time. So you want to work part-time, for example, for employee A and for employee B. So that's a part-time, and that's up to 1 year. So the work permit is issued for 1 year. And then there's a mission permit, which is for if you as a company, you want to bring somebody from outside to work for you temporarily, and that's up to 3 months. That's renewable, and so on and so forth. So ultimately, I think one of the... if anybody is interested, either as a company or as an employee in any of these types of work permits, I refer you to Administrative Resolution number 33 of 2022, and it is available on the MOHRE, or the Ministry of Human Resources and Amortization website. It's translated in English, so it sets out, you don't need to be a lawyer to understand, because there's
Good.
Tables with procedures
Okay.
and requirements and documents and so forth. But one important highlight I want to make is if you want to work for part-time, because that's the question that we have seen over and over again, if you want to work for part-time while you're working for somebody else or a temporary work permit, do you require approval or consent from your current employer? Mm-hmm. And the short answer is yes.
Okay. Okay, if you do want any clarity on that, and that could be to do with visas or time scales or type of companies that would be eligible for this kind of work permit, by all means, do get in touch. And let's stay with work, with employment law. Anonymous message here, as I said earlier, don't worry about putting your name on a message if you'd rather not to. Saying, a friend works at a medical clinic and has not been paid for 4 months. The clinic has also let health insurance lapse. Other doctors have resigned and filed cases, but she's choosing to stay and hope. Are there penalties for not maintaining health insurance? And if so, what is the process for involving the police to force the company to cover their employees? And can she attach the clinic's bank account to secure her salary? The irony of a medical clinic not offering health insurance has not escaped me on this message. What would be the recourse for this employee? It sounds, saying looking to hope, stay in hope, sounds pretty hopeless.
Indeed, and it is a loaded question. Ultimately, there is always a recourse, and there is a recourse to not only get paid your unpaid salary, but also perhaps damages that you would have incurred as a result of the termination, your premature termination of your insurance, a health insurance. But these are all legal, I guess, ramifications or legal options. But I'd say from a practical standpoint, you don't necessarily, I would not recommend that you stay much longer in this country without the health insurance, because God forbid something were to happen. Yes, perhaps legally speaking, you can then file a court case against the company and then pursue them for the damages
and
that
then
you have suffered.
How much money are you going to have in your bank account to cover expenses until you get that
indeed,
back?
And especially the medical expenses, because those need to be paid kind of more or less before you check
the
out of the hospital. Yes. So I'd say in practical terms, I would recommend that perhaps you, as you rightfully said, Helen, give up hope. Because, I mean, somebody, if you have not been paid for 4 months, it's a fairly long period of time. And since others are resigning, that's an indication for you in terms of the perhaps the financial state of the hospital. So what you want to do is you want to file a claim against the hospital. You don't filing a claim is the same as filing a court case. So you just file a claim with the Ministry of Human Resources and Amortization, and you do this just purely on the website or through the app. And then you've lodged your claim, and they see if that gets resolved. Because it is possible, ultimately, once you, if that does not get resolved, you file a court case, and then through the court case, you can, in fact, seize and freeze companies' bank accounts, and the hospital's bank accounts, and other assets in order to secure the payment of your ultimate dues, which would have to be decided or adjudicated through the court.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I really hope that helps.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Joining us live is Ludmila Imalova. She's in the studio, she's in the hot seat and is ready to take your questions on all aspects of the law. Please don't worry about putting your name on a message if you'd rather not. We've had a number of anonymous messages and some with names as well. It's absolutely fine. The way to contact the studio this afternoon, as ever, is 4001 on the SMS. You've got that ARN Play app. It's free to download, free to message. And you've got the WhatsApp too, 0487155500. We've just been talking about part-time and temporary work permits and a bit of a follow-up question, but really related to working legally and what kind of caps are in place. This is from B, saying, my husband was made redundant during COVID. He has professional diplomas, but no degree. How limiting is that for working here?
Not at all. It really depends on the industry and the role that he's seeking. So there are limitations in terms of senior and managerial responsibilities. Those do require a university degree in most cases, or if it's a very specific and technical fields, for example, engineering, law, accounting, and such, those specific professions also require diplomas. But there's plenty of other options that do not require a university degree. That's one. And two, there's an option, another option, which is one that we recommend quite a bit these days, is to get your own freelance license, for example, through the DDA, which is Dubai Development Authority, and that's previously known as TCOM. So there's a freelance license which does not require for you to have a degree, but then you have your own license and you can go and freelance your own services, or you contract out your services to different employers. So that's another option.
That's interesting. So the kind of the managerial, is that more to do with a title rather than a job role? Does that make sense? A company might specify a specific job.
Exactly, yes. So it's if you apply, and it's actually this requirement comes more from the authority, the regulatory authority, where you apply for the work permit or for the visa. And so there, if you have in your title a manager, and that is sort of it's a designation that exists with that particular authority, so anything within that category does require, and actually specifically states, if you're applying for this category of roles, then it will require require a university degree. So yes, it has to be more specific as part of the authority's own requirements, not so much what you do on a day-to-day basis.
Okay, really hope that helps. Being all the very best in the job hunt. Will is asking about a will. Saying, can a will be read without informing one of the main benefactors? And once it's been read, can the beneficiary request to see a copy of the will? Any advice or insight would be much appreciated.
Yes, indeed. You don't require the beneficiary's sign-off or approval to actually be designated as beneficiaries. We do require that if you appoint somebody as a trustee, for example, in that case, you need to submit a specific document from the trustee that acknowledges to take the responsibility. But that has to do more with the responsibility / liability that you are ultimately imposing on that person versus when you are beneficiary, by very definition of the word, you stand to benefit more than to carry liability. So no, there's no approval that's required. And certainly if they want to have a copy of the will whenever you can, there's no breach of the underlying law if you do share a copy of the will with them whenever they want to see one.
Okay, really hope that helps. And Rishi's been in touch on the text line saying, we've just been contacted by our landlord who wants to put the rent up by 25%. The cap is 20%, right?
So indeed, yes.
Okay, I've got a bit of hope in that, right? Question mark. So what is your reply then to that kind of notification from a landlord?
Well, there's several things. So it's not just that you can, the maximum you can increase is 20 or 25%. It's more about how much below the market rate your particular rent is. So the cap relates to the margin which you can increase. So in the simplest terms, so for example, if your rent is less than 50% below the market, then you can opt for the maximum increase, the 20%. But if it's, let's say, only 10, 15% below the market, then it could be just a 5% increase that's allowed. So the best way to confirm that is to check the RERA calculator. And as long as we're on this topic, let me offer one more sort of update on that front, is that RERA has recently updated its calculator and index.
You know what I'm going to be doing during the news.
So during our most recent observations or intelligence due diligence, so we've seen perhaps about a 20% increase in terms of the RERA index. But in all fairness, it had not been updated for quite some time, and people were complaining that it was so out of whack with the actual market rate. So there have been some adjustments. So my recommendation is you resort to the RERA index and B, kind of keep an eye on it because it is being updated.
Okay. I really hope that helps. Rishi, all the very best with those negotiations. Keep us posted. Ludmila Maliva is with us this afternoon. She's taking my questions and yours on all aspects of the law. Please do not hesitate to get in touch. You're going to have to be quick, though. We've got a lot of messages to get through. We're going to be talking about child support and also what happens about selling goods secondhand online. We're going to be exploring that a little bit following a nasty message one of our listeners has received.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Joining us live in the studio is Ludmila Maliva from HPL Maliva & Pluka. We've had a number of people asking for Ludmila's details, and I'd be very happy to send them over. If you just want to drop me a little message, I will send you a link. But we've also got a lot of questions for you as well, Ludmila. So this really is your very last chance to get any questions in if something's on your mind about any aspect of the law. We've been discussing employment law, but we've also had questions about rental, family law as well. And staying with family law, no name on this message, and as I said, you don't need to do that, saying, I found out recently my husband of 14 years committed adultery. We've got two small children and he's left the family home. He's refusing to help pay towards the maintenance of our children, and I'm now seeking the advice if there's any such thing as child support agency in Dubai. The Dubai Foundation for Women and Children have already told me that this is an offence, but my solicitor in England believes it could be tricky, hence why I'm now texting for advice here. Well, thank you for getting in touch, and especially during what sounds like a really stressful situation. I think trying to find a port in the storm when you're going through the shock of news such as that, trying to hold things together with the kids and trying to get answers, and indeed in this situation get money that you're due, Ludmila. What is the process here?
Well, there is indeed a process, and there is a framework and adequate protection, I would argue, for families, and not just the children, but also the wives in circumstances like this. So it is tricky by virtue, as you rightfully said, just the emotional turmoil and not having access to money today. But ultimately, what you need to do is you need to file a case for, there's two types of cases you can file. Either you can file for a case for a divorce and, as part of it, support and custody and alimony, or you can just file a case just for alimony for the children and yourself, so without seeking divorce. But I would imagine in this particular case, you may actually want to do a divorce. It doesn't really matter. But the point is that the whether the UAE law is applied, and that is the UAE personal status law, or the law of the country where you got married, which perhaps in this case would be English law, there is plenty of protection, and there's ultimately there's an obligation for the father to support the children, and that's just unequivocal. So in this case, irrespective of which law would be applied, the court will issue an order requiring the father to pay alimony that's sort of proportional to obviously the children's needs and also in the context of his own earning abilities. And it's not something that he can, for example, just hide. So the court here has the ability, and the systems do exist through the courts where you can request to see what his salary is, what his bank accounts are, and the full sort of set of assets. And so the court not only has the ability to see or have visibility to all those assets, but also to ultimately issue a judgment and then freeze and seize any of those assets if the alimony or the support is not being paid. Okay. So it's in that it's not tricky in that sense for in terms of the legal protection, the legal foundation is there. It's just obviously tricky in terms of having to deal with this and file a court case to argue this. So hopefully with a little bit of education, the father of your children will come to his senses and will not fight this. Because it doesn't need to be acrimonious. I mean, you'd hope to see the light and then just ultimately do the right thing, because legally he cannot escape whether he's here or in the UK.
Can I ask about... And we were discussing family finances on the show last week, and Carol Glynn saying that a frightening number of women stay in relationships that they are not happy in or they're even abused in because of the fear on the other side of not being able to support themselves and their families financially. What would you advise anyone going into a marriage now? And I'm thinking about women in particular, in terms of protecting themselves, whether it's financially or legally, documentation. What would you tell your best friend?
I'm sure. I just mean be sensible and be practical, and always remember about yourself first. So if you choose not to work for whatever reason, then make sure be sensible along the way, and at least have your own bank account. I think it's extremely important, because a lot of women here do not have their own bank accounts. They are either signatories or joint account holders, but they don't have their own. So bank account one, and then make sure to populate it on a regular basis. Two, have your own phone as well that is registered to your own name, because something like this can really just pull the rug from under your feet if all of a sudden your husband, who is the primary account holder on your phone, will disconnect your phone line, and then you're really out of your element. Make sure that you have, for example, something registered to your name, either a lease. If you're renting property, then you should try to be on the lease as well, so you don't have to deal with cases which we see too many where the husband wants the wife to leave the house now because he is the primary holder on the lease. Or a title deed, if you're buying any kind of assets, make sure that you are on the title deed. Don't be shy to ask. You don't necessarily, if you don't think that you've contributed enough, then at least you don't have to be 50-50, but at least have some kind of a share. And ultimately, if you are spending any of your own money, because also, which is what we see, that let's say the wife is putting her own savings from before, and then ultimately she's not on any of the assets, then document this. As long as you have documentation, you will be able to recoup a lot of these finances through the courts. So I think just be practical and just remember that you need to kind of look after yourself first, and because then if the children come into the equation, if you have not taken care of your own sort of needs, and it becomes very scary for a lot of people.
Thanks for that, Ludmilla. I really hope that helps anyone having some doubts or just looking to, as you say, kind of equip yourself. No one goes into a relationship or marriage expecting to find yourself in the divorce courts, but unfortunately statistics suggest that more people than we might like to see do go there. Great question from Michelle here, saying, hi, I want to merge two companies in the UAE, one in Dubai and one in Abu Dhabi. How can I do this without liquidation of one of those companies? Thank you.
Well, the easiest way I can think of, it's not quite necessarily merge, merging, but basically consolidating to an extent, is let's say if you have a Dubai entity and Abu Dhabi entity and your main business is in Abu Dhabi, then the Abu Dhabi company becomes the shareholder, the 100% shareholder of your Abu Dhabi branch. So in that case, you ultimately have one legal structure for both businesses. But in that case, you still will need to have to pay for the license fees for your Abu Dhabi entity. But if you set up or you structure that Abu Dhabi business as a branch of your Dubai business, then you don't need to do a separate audit, for example. You don't need to have a separate bank account. So it really becomes kind of an extension of the, if the Dubai entity, but still will have to carry its own at least licensing fees. Now, that's ultimately, that's one way. The other way, and other than that, if you basically, if you don't want one or the other location, you will need to have to go through liquidation, or you can sell the company, the shares of the company, to somebody else, the third party.
Okay. All right, Charlotte, really hope that helps. This question kind of piqued my interest. This is from Shaz, saying, I've stayed at a hotel for 6 months at a rent of 8,000 dirhams per month. Now they've suddenly increased the rent to 18,000 dirhams per month, saying they're expecting a lot of business during the World Cup. Is this allowed? Can I file a complaint? But do you remember before the UAE, before Dubai won Expo 2020, and it was like, this is the rent if we don't win it. This is the rent if we do. I was like, this is crazy. This is crazy. So we think about the economic knock-on effect of events, whether it's cultural or sporting. Can a hotel do this? I mean, I'm guessing it's theirs to set, but...
Well, there's nothing in the law that precludes them from doing this, except, but it can be contractually regulated. So it could be that in your contract that you've signed, it would be a short-term contract, but it's obviously not the night-by-night. It's perhaps like monthly contract. So review the details of that contract, because there may be some limitation in terms of how much they can increase rent and what notice they have to give you. Mm-hmm. But really, it would have to be contractual and not so much by law.
If you've heard of anything else along these lines, please let me know. I'm really fascinated to see if this is something that we've heard a little bit more of. Now, to kind of come back to bookend our chat around work, anonymous message here saying, is there a basic salary in Dubai?
Wow, what a great question. So there is, in the new law, there is a provision that provides for minimum salary. And that was the that's the first time we're seeing reference to minimum salary. However, the amount of the minimum salary has not yet been stated. And so that this is supposed to be, I guess, explained, if you will, by virtue of additional resolutions that will come due in due time. But that particular resolution has not been made available yet, so we don't know. There is definitely a reference to minimum wage, but there isn't one specifically that's stated today. Now, in terms of the basic salary, it should not be less than whatever your monthly salary is. So 50% of whatever your monthly salary is. So let's say if it's 1,000 dirhams, it should not be less than 500 dirhams in terms of the percentage. That's as much as I can offer you right now.
Interesting. So you will, of course...
Indeed, I will. And I am actually aware these days there's a lot more arrangements where people work without a salary, more just on a commission basis, okay. In particular in the real estate industry. So legally speaking, there's nothing wrong with it for the time being until the regulations on the minimum wage will become available. And then I will absolutely update.
There are some exceptions to that when we look at domestic workers where their embassy might set a minimum salary.
Yeah, so the domestic workers are governed by a different set of laws. They're not subject to the UAE labor law. They're subject to their own law on domestic workers. And there are regulations about salaries. And as you rightfully said, different. So for domestic workers to be allowed into the country to work as domestic workers, their own countries do negotiate their own agreements and setting minimum salaries basically between the governments. So yes, okay. There's the underlying structure there as well, in addition to the law.
Thank you so, so much, Lynn Miller. Always a pleasure. What's keeping you busy in your office that we've stolen you away from this hour?
We truly have a mixed bag right now. We have a lot of personal cases. There's a lot of divorces, but there's also new births, which is very exciting. There's lots of employment. Immigration. Everybody is in real estate, as always. But immigration, people are so excited about the different types of visas that are being discussed in the public. But we're still waiting for them to be implemented. But there's a lot of quite excitement, if you will, around that. that particular area, because it allows people to have visas if they invest here or if they set up companies, if they've got great academic achievements and so on and so forth. So that has been quite a hot topic.
Well, if we weren't able to get to your message on the text line today, or you are looking to contact Ludmilla to go a bit more in depth about any of your particular situations, you can, of course, find her at HPL Ludmilla Betmpluka. What's the best way of contacting you, Ludmilla?
Our website, and that's www.lylawyers.com.
You can also find her across social media, TikToking. No, not much dancing, more of the informative TikTok.
Yeah, I mean, dancing I could do, but not for the general public. Singing I could not.
The private account for the yoga headstands as well. Ludmilla, you're an absolute star. And if you do want the website there for HPL Ludmilla Betmpluka, drop me a little line. I'd be very happy to send you the link.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking work and working spaces on the show today, and I'm sure many of us have had this kind of thought, wouldn't it be great to have my own coffee shop, start a restaurant, and kind of selfishly solve my own problems on the food front? But when you stop to think about what actually goes into creating a concept, running a successful restaurant, it isn't awful lot of work. If there's a passion of yours and something you're keen to explore, maybe our next guest can help you kickstart that dream. Shahid Bhatti is the founder and CEO of The Co-Spaces and The Co-Kitchens, a brand new concept that is launching in just a couple of weeks. October 4th, how are the preparations going?
Hi, Helen.
Hi.
Really good, actually. It's been a great warm-up. We've been through our pre-launch phase for the last 2 months, and we are now geared up. We've had a few initial concepts. We've already joined the kitchen, and we're really ready. Today, we just got our first our certification by Dubai SME.
Good.
So all steam ahead.
Ticking off the paperwork.
All steam ahead.
We're going to talk about the kitchen, but I'd like to go back a little bit to the co-working spaces. Something when I was a freelancer became a bit of a lifeline, to be truthful, for me in terms of I hate the idea of networking. I hate the word networking, but actually kind of building contacts and having a bit of a community around me as a freelancer. Now, COVID obviously hit and we weren't congregating as much. Can I ask what that kind of bounce back has been like? Because we've also seen the great resignation, a lot of people starting to work for themselves. What's the lie of the land now?
So, I mean, since COVID has affected us, I mean, it's been a very interesting year and a half. We've seen a huge influx of new freelancers, consultants and entrepreneurs starting their own businesses. So that's great on the licensing front. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, people who have that hybrid work model, people who want to, who have the option to work from home or from the office, want to actually come and use a co-working space such as the Co Dubai that we have in downtown. It's just that hybrid in between working from home, working in a small office or working in a corporate office, mm-hmm. to have that balance to socialize, meet new people and have a productive day.
That's really encouraging to hear. I understand that. I mean, I've tried to work from home doing the show. I did the show twice and it was a disaster because the dogs were barking, the kids were around. But I think for a lot of people, that idea of working from home has been fantastic. For others, it's not helpful. You need to be in that workspace mindset, and a third space, like a co-working element, can be hugely helpful. You've now developed this, as I said, into the co-kitchens. What's it all about?
So, yeah, so as we created a co-working space within the office industry, we then in 2018 created our first co-working kitchen in London. And with our community in Dubai, we had all of our foodie entrepreneurs asking us when we would be able to open up something similar. And it's taken us that many years to be able to open this up. Because of different things, because of course, COVID hit, because of the red tape around food businesses in the UAE. So finally, we've been able to create a co-working kitchen. And this is probably a phrase I think only we use. It's not really, there's a lot of other types of concepts such as cloud kitchen, dark kitchen. But we refer to our space as a co-working kitchen and a food business incubator. So it goes beyond just the physical space of the kitchen. It also goes into more about the support that's needed for the food idea, food concepts who are at the idea stage, whether it's the licensing and permits, whether it's the branding and packaging, all the way to the retail and the business strategy as well.
So when we think about the kind of companies you're going to be working with, could you kind of break it down? Who do you have in mind? And, you know, if you could wave a magic wand and have a certain type of person or business under your roof, who would you like to see there?
So as I said, we've had our pre-launch phase for the last 2 months. So our own network, our own community, we've had a lot of applications of food concepts who've applied to join. We've selected four or five already. A lot of bakers. Shout out to Shabalicious Bakers, Anjali Bakes. We've got some popsicle concepts, sauces, pre-packaged. Bottled sauces. So those are the ones who've already joined us. We're really focusing on the smaller micro-sized businesses because I think that's where the support is needed. But at the same time, we've had some international brands who've contacted us to open up their local delivery
concepts. That's interesting. In terms of kind of testing the waters
exactly.
a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. We've also had some restaurants who have their operations already in Dubai who want to open up a separate facility where they can create bottled sauces under their existing brand. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting model. We're seeing from across the board, the small micro-sized ideas as well as the international food businesses.
Questions from me and questions mm-hmm. from those listening today. Mm-hmm. Andy saying, where is the space and how many people will you be able to accommodate once fully operational? Great question, Andy.
Great question. So we are located in Jebel Ali. So this is an ideal situation where location for Abu Dhabi concepts as well as Dubai-based concept. The delivery, the location allows you to deliver across that area. At full capacity, we can have about 40 members who can be part of the community and part of the program. And that's broken down. So similar to a cloud kitchen where you may be renting a physical space or a unit 24/7 access and you're paying essentially a monthly rent, with our model, you would be able to rent or become a member and access a prep table, a station, but it could be once a month to produce 100 batches of your products. It could be once a week or it could be 7 days a week.
So much more flexible.
Much more flexible.
Okay. Yes. If you've got any questions, please do get in touch. If this is something that's, you know, sparking some ideas in your mind and you're keen to learn more, this is your chance. Shahzad Bhatti is with us. He's the co-founder and CEO of the Co Spaces and the Co Kitchens, which is opening in a couple of weeks, but they are already warming up. Question from Neil saying, what kind of business license would you need to have in place to join? Neil, we're coming to your question next.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Now, if you've always had a dream of starting your own, maybe it's a hot sauce company, maybe you're an avid baker or want to turn it into a bit of a side hustle, but want to make sure you're doing it legally and with some extra support as well. Perhaps our current guest, Shahzad Bhatti, the founder and CEO of Co Spaces and also now the Co Kitchens, is on hand to help. And we've had a number of you getting in touch, so clearly tapping into something here. On October 4th, they're going to be launching this facility in Jebel Ali, and somewhat different to a cloud kitchen because of the flexibility of the plans of the space on offer. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about, I guess, it's not just the space, though. It's the sense of community and support. And, you know, the phrase you use is kind of business incubator. Can you unpack that a little bit more about what are you calling the members will have access to?
We call them members. We call them food concepts. Essentially, they are part of our community. We work with them one on one. We're all supporting not just from our side and my team. It's also each other. They're all going through similar entrepreneurial journeys and they are all, you know, connecting with each other, supporting each other, whether they're exchanging ideas on packaging that they've used, whether they're exchanging ideas on the retail strategy. So it's about really working together. We call it an incubator and a food business incubator because essentially apart from the physical workspace, we're also helping them set up, get the product labels registered and assessed, helping them import the food and products. We're helping them with getting event permits, a lot of the pop-up markets and food truck and events and festivals.
Tis the
well.
Season.
Yes.
Let's go to the text line. Raj saying, what is the cost of the co-space and how does it compare to similar offerings? Great question. Thanks, Johnny. Can you break that down for us? Because
yes.
I'm sure there must be people listening today going, do you know what? I've always dreamt of turning my granny's jam recipe and everybody loves it. But how can I scale this up and perhaps use a space and make sure it is legal and licensed and profitable? So what about the costs involved?
Yeah, so we've got three or four different membership types. The first is called the idea stage. This is when you're developing the idea, testing the products, and you're probably producing very small quantities of that and trying to test if it will actually sell in the market. That starts from 25,000 dirhams per year. That gives you access once a month to come in access the kitchen, produce in a small batch, whether that's 100 sauces, whether that's, you know, whatever that may be. And then it goes up to using accessing the kitchen once a week, twice a week, up all the way up to 7 days a week. And that can go up to 125,000 dirhams if you have full unlimited access.
And does that include business licenses? Because Neil's followed up with saying, what kind of business license would you need to have in place before joining? So can you kind of connect the dots there a little bit?
Exactly. So if you are in the idea stage, essentially you don't need a license. We're incubating your product and supporting you with developing the product, getting you to be able to legally sell that in the market. So at the idea stage, whilst we're incubating you, you can work and operate without the license. But as soon as you start moving on to the next memberships, you can then apply for your own mainland license. We are certified by Dubai SME, which means we work with mainland licensing authorities.
So let's just workshop it. Let's say my granny's raspberry jam recipe was phenomenal. Would you then advise, so let's say you get involved in that idea stage, apart from access to the space, how else would you be looking to promote granny's jam? Apart from helping with the name, which obviously is number one priority.
Yeah. So we've been lucky enough, we ran a program called the Retail Accelerator Program for a number of years. And through that program and our contacts within the food industry, we've been able to build this network of suppliers, retailers, everything from branding design agencies, freelancers. So essentially, when you join the program, when you join our food incubator, you can access everything, not just the physical space, but also support in the permits, support in designing the product packaging. We have a mentor session every month where we sit down. We have mentors such as business and strategy, which is my experience. Mm-hmm. We have food operation, who is Emmanuel, who's our kitchen manager. We have Sartag, who's our IT guy, who helps with all the e-commerce, setting up your online store. So we can essentially guide you through our experience and working specifically for your brand to get it off the ground.
And lastly, any trends that you're anticipating coming to market in the F&B space here in the UAE?
Yes, we've seen a lot of health-conscious food products that are locally made. There's a lot of, protein bars, granola bars, energy protein bars, etc., even drinks. A lot of them are imported from outside, but we're now starting to see new concepts launching them within the UAE. We're hoping that our co-working kitchen can actually help them get off the ground.
And a number of people saying how to get in touch. I'll hand that over to you.
You can visit us at thecokitchens.com. That's kitchens plural with an S at the end. Thecokitchens.com or on Instagram, thecokitchens. We have an application form. All of the information is there and you can reach out to us and someone from the team will show you around.
Thank you so, so much.
Thank you
really
very
interesting.
Much,
hopefully that has sparked a few ideas. And if you did hear it through Dubai Eye 103.8, I will be accepting some kind of commissions on your future success. Is that something you do?
Of course, of course. Lots of free foodies.
Yeah. Share your ideas and share the wealth too. Thank you so, so much. Really do appreciate it, Shazad.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
So any of you aspiring entrepreneurs in the beauty or indeed wellness industry, our next guest has some great tips for you when it comes to creating and sustaining a successful business. Valerie Reynat is the CEO and founder of a beauty consultancy platform. It's VR Beauty Consultants. She helps aspiring and current beauty salon owners in this region to break through, to stay there, and really talking about best practices all the way from the salon floor up to director level, which is exactly what you have done, Valerie. You came to the region back in 2003 as a beauty therapist yourself and have worked your way up the corporate ladder. What was it like arriving in Dubai and how did you kind of start to navigate that space as a therapist initially?
Well, when I first arrived in 2003, I really was thinking to take on a job as a beauty therapist, but it actually turned out that I landed my first job as a trainer for one of the leading beauty distributors in the region, which at that time I didn't realize, but it was a great foundation actually for where I am at right now, mm-hmm. because at that moment I trained in so many salons, which made me understand how actually those businesses were run here.
And how they work and how sometimes they don't work.
Yes,
this
correctly.
Is a big business here in the UAE from, you know, your kind of day-to-day salons where someone might go in for a quick polish change or a blow dry all the way through to, you know, really incredible products and decadent pampering. And we have a lot of turnover as well in terms of places opening and closing. What do you think makes a successful company stick?
Well, first of all, you know, I think that people need to realize that it's not just doing nails and hair. So that's a, you know, a big mistake that people have, you know, when they step into this industry. As well, you know, for me, I always, you know, advise my clients that let us look at, you know, what kind of brand do you want to establish? So really, what is the purpose of, you know, setting up the business? And besides that, once we have established, you know, the mission and, you know, really positioned the brand, then we look at the financial plan. So, you know, what exactly is it that, you know, how much investment do you need, you know, to set up the business? And then as well, when can you expect to break even? And so, again, we've seen a lot of people that had no idea of, you know, what initial investment should be there. Mm-hmm. And before they actually could really start the operations, you know, then they were already out of money.
Already on the back foot. I wanted to talk to you as well about staff and treatment of, because unfortunately we have heard people come here and having really tough time, especially in those kind of roles. And how do you tend to advise companies setting up to make sure that staff are really well looked after?
So first of all, it's really crucial that people know that you have to continuously develop, you know, the people that, you know, work with you. And I've seen that over the years. People say like, yeah, but, you know, she has 15 years of experience and she should know how to, you know, what is excellent customer service. And I said, yeah, but if you expect that she knows, maybe all her previous employers, you know, they expected that as well. So she's actually never been trained as well. Maybe what you expect is, as you know, great customer service is something else than somebody else expects. So, you know, this is where it all starts, you know, because 50% is really the technical skills, but the other 50% is very much everything that has to do with, you know, outstanding customer service. And people need to be trained on that, because as well, people come from all different parts in the world and cultures are different, countries are different. So, you know, this is one thing that, you know, have your client journey in place, train them, and then as well, keep developing. And I say not only professionally, but also personally. So
I think that's a really interesting point, actually, because it almost becomes like pastoral care for an employer. And, you know, when you've got a big expat workforce, because people are far from home, you know, people perhaps might be more vulnerable than they would be in their home country. And it's that element of, as you say, kind of looking after all aspects of their life. We're talking the business of beauty today, some kind of salon do's and don'ts. If you want to give a shout out to anybody in your life on the beauty front, by all means, but equally if you are thinking about dipping your toe into the industry of beauty or wellness, I want to pick the brains of some of the best in the business. We've got Valerie Reinhart with us through until 4 o'clock today. Feel free to get in touch.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking about the beauty industry this afternoon, answering your questions if you are looking to get involved in it. Maybe you've got an idea and you want development. Maybe you are already in the business but need a bit of a helping hand. Joining us now is Valerie Reinhart. She's the CEO and founder of a beauty consultancy platform, VR Beauty Consulting, and she does help aspiring and existing beauty salon owners and people who've got an idea to get off the ground, keep the customers coming in. We're answering some of your questions this afternoon as well. And I think a lot of people really just wanting a bit of direction, Valerie, on what's involved in running a beauty industry here. So let's unpack this question here. We've got one here from Janice saying, I wonder why your mic's not working. There we go. Janice is saying, I've always dreamed of starting a wellness spa that offers yoga classes and massages and meditation. Would it be better to collaborate with a small hotel that doesn't have its own spa, or is it easier to do it independently? Interesting question.
Well, I think it's something to, you know, that you really have to look into, because when it comes to hotels, they of course have their own rules and their own specifications. So, you know, does that match with, you know, what you want to do? If you start your own independent business, then you have the freedom to actually run it the way that you want. So of course, you know, when you're based in an hotel, you know, you can leverage on the footfall that's there in the hotel. So that's definitely an advantage. So I think you really have to look at the pros and cons and then decide, you know, what would work best for you.
When you're working with clients, and I know you do quite a bit of kind of mystery shopping with existing beauty salons about what could be tweaked in order to bring more people in or to be positioned as experts in certain fields. What about location? What works and what doesn't work when it comes to location?
Well, the location, you really have to determine, you know, where you need to be as what your brand stands for. So again, you know, it comes to really understanding, you know, what is your mission? You know, what is your unique selling proposition and who do you want to cater to? Mm. Once you define, you know, who you're going to cater to, then you can look into locations. So is your target market there? So that's really, you know, a very important, you know, point to decide on where to open.
So this is looking at, you know, the type of products, the price point, of course. Yes. You know, you're not going to be putting a crazy high-end, you know, salon in an area where, you know, rents are traditionally low and people aren't going to have that disposable income. So creating that match. I wanted to ask you, I think this is a really good question from Fran, saying, what are your thoughts on these mobile salons and spas that come to your home? Are they regulated? Really interesting point, Fran.
Well, they should be regulated. Mm-hmm. So the home service businesses, they actually trade under salon license. So they are, you know, officially, you know, licensed beauty salons. But mainly then, you know, they might operate from, you know, a different location. So again, the license for home service are not there, but, you know, they are regulated under beauty salon license. So it is allowed.
Valerie, we've all seen these posts on social media about help just back from the hairdressers and my hair is orange, falling out, frazzled, you know, I've got chemical burns or, you know, whatever the disaster has been. What kind of recourse is there for clients if things do go wrong in these type of environments in terms of whether it's legal recourse or compensation?
Well, you know, it's very important for salon owners, you know, to make sure that they have the right insurance. So in case that something goes wrong, that at least, you know, they are, you know, they are covered. As for the clients, you know, I do believe it's very important to file, you know, a complaint about that, because that's the only way that we can stop, you know, having people work without the right qualifications. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, we can only do that together. Yeah. So again, you know, something can happen in cases that, for example, somebody had henna on the hair and they didn't disclose that. And of course, you know, we need to look case to case. But again, for salon owners, it's so crucial that they have the right insurance from, you know, the start of the salon business. Yeah.
Interesting point here from Emily saying, what does the law say about patch tests? Now, for any chaps or probably chaps listening today who don't know what kind of a patch test is, and it could be to do with tinting eyebrows or tinting hair. Is that something that a salon is legally required to ask of a client? Because whenever they say it to me, I'm like, no, it'll be fine. And thank goodness, it always has been.
So I actually recommend people to actually say yes to that.
Who's got the time to come back 24 hours later?
Yeah, but you know, if people say no, then at least it's been offered. And, you know, I always provide to my clients the documents as well that, mm-hmm. you know, the client has to sign off that, okay, it was recommended. But that, you know, the client decided not to do. So if anything happens afterwards, that they're safe.
You're covered.
Yeah.
Last question. Sonam saying there are so many salons that offer facials, but I find that some of them are not actually experts. They just know how to use the machine. How do we check, or what do we need to ask before booking a treatment to know that someone is credible?
Well, when it comes to facials, so to skincare, so we have seen a shift more to the medical centres than the beauty salons.
I think, and this is what I prefer as well. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's nice to have a kind of a nice gentle aromatherapy massage on your face. But I think most people now, being strapped for time, want results. So
yeah,
going down that more of the aesthetic, you know, route and wanting to come out with, you know, glowing skin, but, you know, whether it's extractions done or anti-aging. And a lot of them are in more of a clinic setting.
Yeah, but, you know, salons can do it. But then, you know, it's, you know, they have to have DHA license, especially when they want to work with machines. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in that case, if you visit a salon and they want to offer you any facials with, you know, including machines, then just check if the, you know, if the beauty therapist is DHA licensed.
And last question for anyone who is thinking about dabbling or jumping both feet in to the beauty industry, what are some of the questions you should be asking yourself and indeed perhaps those around you before you start a new career or start a pretty significant side hustle, Valerie?
Well, first of all, I always say make sure that you know that you're going to be very dedicated, yeah, because it's not a walk in the park. It's not just nails and hair. So, you know, be sure of, you know, what you want to do, you know, again, what the brand stands for. Do you have the financials, you know, available? And I would say if you don't have the knowledge, but you're very passionate, you know, do work with a consultant, mm-hmm. because we can contact contribute, you know, so much, and we can make sure that you avoid so many errors that others do make.
And lastly, any predictions for trends in the beauty space here in the UAE? What are we seeing more of?
I think, you know, it's again, it's an ever evolving industry. So, you know, every day we wake up and we think, OK, what's new now in our industry? So I think, you know, what people really have to focus on a lot is sustainability. Mm-hmm. So that really is, you know, it's aside from, you know, new trends that are coming up, I think being, you know, sustainable, it's a big next step.
And if anyone does want to contact you about exploring some of their ideas or maybe just wanting to tap into some of your knowledge if they already have a beauty business, what's the best way of getting in touch?
So they can contact me on through LinkedIn on Valerie Reynard or Instagram VR Beauty Consulting.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking careers this afternoon, and just imagine, you know, you're scanning the career sites online and you come across your ultimate job. It is perfect. You want it bad. But wait, they're looking for someone with 10 years experience managing a large team. They prefer someone with MBAs. And while you've got some great experience, you definitely don't have those things. Should you apply, or would it be a waste of everybody's time if you don't have what that position is really asking for? How can you show you can handle a job you're not fully qualified for? To help us unpack this is Deepak Bhatva, MD of NSI and Bluefin Talent, and they focus on careers in consulting and banking. To explain a little bit more, if you've got any questions or want to share your experiences, many listeners have been getting in touch, please do. Now, Deepak, when Sheryl Sandberg published her book Lean In back in 2013, there was a catchy finding that started to turn into a bit of kind of perceived wisdom that men apply for positions when they meet just 60% of the requirements, while women only apply if they meet 100% of them. Do you think there's any truth in that? What have you experienced?
So I think from my perspective, from what I've seen, certainly from a regional standpoint, I would say that I can't really differentiate and say that that's true. What I have seen, though, I've seen a massive push from large organizations, large corporates, regional players that have an emphasis on diversity and inclusion from a hiring standpoint. So if there was any truth in that, I would say that, you know, it doesn't make sense.
Okay.
If you are female and you're kind of, you know, 50% plus aligned to the position at hand, it makes more sense to apply than not.
And what about regional differences? You've worked in the UK, you're obviously here, global presence. Do you feel like standards kind of change a little bit depending on just how stringent those qualifications need to be?
I think certainly in the UK, there's more openness. There's a lot more flexibility. You know, even if you look at firms like EY used to have a requirement that you could only... you needed a degree, basically, for them to consider you. They dropped that requirement in 2015. PwC had a requirement that you could only be considered if you had a 2-1. They dropped that.
Me out.
So, yeah, they dropped that requirement this year. So I think there is a lot more flexibility in the UK. Mm. The region is probably more tough from that perspective.
Why do you think that is, Deepak?
I think it's still quite old school, right, in terms of the mentality and the hiring managers and, you know, just having a more traditional mindset. Academics matter. It's usually more kind of 1+1=2.
Mm-hmm. Rather than, I don't want to say not being open-minded to candidates, but I mean, there's a lot. What's the market like now? Who do you think's holding the power?
I think candidates hold a lot more power, certainly in the industries that we work. But we work very niche, I guess, high-end industries. Mm-hmm. And in those markets, those candidates have more opportunities than kind of, you know, so there's a war for that talent.
Let's see if we can offer some tips up about perhaps getting past the recruiter, the hiring manager. We talk a lot about keywords and how obviously that kind of software that's filtering some of the applications. Is there a way of, let's say you need a specific qualification, but you haven't got it. Could you, for example, say studying towards my XYZ? Would that help? Any tips?
I think it helps getting your CV noticed, but I think you have to kind of look at the JD and make an analysis of what are the must-haves, what are the nice-to-haves, and then really be honest with yourself in terms of, okay, I've got this, I haven't got this. Have I done anything close to this? Okay, maybe I've done it there, which is a little bit different, but I think being able to, I guess, get past the gatekeeper, if that's what you want to call it, you need to be able to articulate your ideas in a very clear, concise way. And if you can do that in writing, like, you know, if you can talk about the impact that you've made, if you can show that you've kind of maybe led teams as opposed to managed teams, just having that degree of flexibility and that degree of creativity is certainly going to help you at least get considered.
Is there any argument for perhaps bypassing that traditional application route and getting in touch with somebody through LinkedIn and saying, I've seen this opportunity, here is what I can do for you, here is how I can quantify success, here's how I can deliver?
That always gives you an edge, definitely, right? So if you genuinely believe,
yeah, that you can deliver,
you
on
can
that.
Deliver on that role, I would, yeah, it makes sense to do that, because at the very least, most of the time, it might get you a conversation.
Let's go to the text line. Inka saying, I often write job descriptions or help write them, and we know it's unlikely someone ticks every single box. So if you've got 8 years experience instead of 10, we might still consider a candidate depending on the other criteria too. She says, I do see a lot of CVs and most men big themselves up massively. I'm just going to leave it there. Janine saying, I took a leap of faith and did this and got the job. I found it hard, but I'm still here. I felt like a bit of a fool and I've got things wrong, but I've got really supportive colleagues. My advice to anyone in the same boat is apply, be honest and see what happens. The be honest, I think, is crucial, because you can't fudge qualifications. You know, things need to be attested. People will be doing their due diligence on your references as well.
100%. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't make sense to lie. But I think if you can kind of, if you've got some sort of experience that aligns roughly to what the requirements are, then it's, you know, part and parcel of being able to sell yourself is to kind of, you know, show that you can, or demonstrate that relationship.
Sammy's saying, you can choose to apply for the job, but let the employer decide if you're suitable. Unless it's brain surgery or similar, you can quickly learn anything. You need to fill any knowledge gaps. What's the worst that can happen? You don't get the job. You haven't got it now, so just go for it. I think that's a really interesting point. What do you have to lose? I think, you know, we've spoken before about how, I mean, my CV is not a good example of this. Mine is on my computer desktop just getting dusty. But if you are actively looking for jobs, this is a living, breathing document that you check in with and you adapt and you update. Depending on the job you're applying for, I mean, surely kind of reaching is a good exercise in adjusting your CV, applying, hopefully interviewing.
I think having too wide a kind of
gap,
in terms of what you're applying for is absolutely the wrong thing to do, because if your CV is too many places, it automatically somehow you're devaluing yourself, right?
Cheapening your offering.
Yeah, exactly. So you want to be quite targeted, quite specific in terms of what you're doing, in terms of where you're applying, and then those slight deviations in terms of, you know, amending the CV, amending parts of your experience to align is a much better way of doing it.
Well, I think that's really interesting to hear from, and also great to hear that the candidate's got more power than we'd realise right now, certainly in industries that you're specialising in there at NSI and Bluefin Talent as well. If anyone does want to reach out to you, what's the best way of getting in touch, Deepak?
You can reach out to hello at NSI Talent or hello at bluefintalent.com.
Thank you so much for your time. Really do appreciate it. And if you want to share any success stories, or if you've got any questions when it comes to recruitment, careers, let us know. It's a topic we touch on every single Monday afternoon.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We're talking the business of beauty this afternoon. Have you ever thought to yourself, I'd love to try this, maybe start a new career, a side hustle, but I didn't train in that. Maybe it's just too late for me. Maybe our next guest will convince you that it's never too late. Ophelia Untanlin went from being a head nurse to a successful entrepreneur of not one but two businesses, Laundry Heroes and Ophelia's Beauty Salon. She joins us on the phone now. If you want to share your stories or indeed your career dreams, we'd love to hear from you. Ophelia, how are you this afternoon?
I am good. From Jeddah to Dubai.
Thank you for making the time. You are joining us from Jeddah this afternoon. And your journey first started in Saudi Arabia, as I said, working as a nurse. Tell us about that experience and when you first got that entrepreneurial bug.
Okay. I arrived in Saudi Arabia. I worked as a nurse last 2010. And then, of course, because we are very poor in the Philippines. So while working as a nurse, I started to become an entrepreneur by selling skincare products from the Philippines. Yeah,
and that was obviously to get a bit of extra money. But it sounds like that was a bit of a start for you in the kind of the beauty business, and started thinking, what else could I do? And that's led you to Dubai. You've started Ophelia's Lady Salon. It's the first salon actually in a Dubai hospital. It's in Al Zahra Hospital. Why did you decide to choose a location such as a medical facility? What was that decision about?
Okay. Since I'm engaged and to skincare products for more than a decade since I started in Saudi Arabia while working as a nurse, I'm selling a skincare products, which is, I love to do it, and because I need to earn extra money, because, you know, the purpose of going abroad, of course, we want to change our lives. And we want to have a brighter future for ourselves and for our family. I started to get engaged into saloon services during COVID. That was the start of COVID last 2020, when that, of course, because of COVID and everything affected selling of the skincare products. I started to have training on doing eyelashes. So I started during COVID time. After my training, I'm doing eyelashes thing as my part-time after working as a nurse. And then the concept in Dubai, I started to have my own business in Dubai. I started the laundry business. So the first quarter of 2011.
So this is Laundry Heroes, and now you've got two businesses. Can I ask, when you're working with patients and patients' families, and they're having, you know, a pampering session or, you know, a much needed hair wash and just a bit of peace and relaxation in what can be a really stressful time if they're not well or a loved one is in the hospital, what impact do you think a bit of care and attention and beauty can make in their life?
Okay. I want first to share the story, what happened, why we built the first hospital salon in Dubai. I have my boss here in Saudi Arabia, and he knows about my story, how determined I am when it comes to being an entrepreneur, and how to he is amazed, I'm into beauty services like that. So they know that I have this laundry business in Dubai, and then they offered me the concept of they called me for this concept. So I went to Al Zahra Hospital. They told me because, you know, I'm a nurse by profession. I already gave up my profession as a nurse, and I'm focusing now in skincare and the beauty salon. So yeah. So they offered me this concept in Al Zahra Hospital. I'm a nurse, and then we want someone to build a salon inside the hospital, to take care of their patients, especially those ladies after deliveries. Because, you know, I found it very interesting, because my profession as a nurse, at the same time, a beautician. So, I really want to do this project. So I made it possible by building a salon inside the hospital. It's really unique concept, and I love to I'm a nurse. So before, I'm taking care of their medical condition. Now I'm taking care of their beautification, which is really something unique concept, and I love to do it.
And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.